Hello and welcome back to The Shift of Land. I'm Sarah Parker. The Shift of Land is a 13-part series which focuses on the connection between land, culture, and agriculture in New Mexico. Because we live in a global economy and worldwide trends inevitably affect us here in New Mexico, in this program, we will look at agricultural trends globally.
Well, let's take a couple of examples. Let's take water.
Dr. Sylvia Rodriguez, professor of anthropology at UNM.
We're facing water crisis of catastrophic proportions in the 21st century, all over the world. It's going to hit hardest and fastest in the arid regions, and the people who are going to experience it most extremely soonest, of course, are the poor people. You already see this along the border, where you have people living in colonias where their water is hauled in trucks and stored in barrels. You cross from Juarez, from El Paso into Juarez, and the water situation is radically different.
One trend globally is the privatization of water. Communities in developing countries have had their waters privatized through World Bank and World Trade Organization programs. Water is seen as a human need rather than a human right. That means that a need can be met through the market with money. A right is something that we all must have regardless. At a First Peoples workshop in defense of water in Mexico City in 2005, six forms of water privatization were laid out for the participants who came from various indigenous communities around the world. They are as follow: the privatization of water in urban zones by private purifying contractors. Whole territories and bioregions become privatized by companies for monopoly practices through the help of the governments. Industrial and agribusiness users are given large dams and new water irrigation technologies which bypass traditional water users like small farmers and indigenous peoples. The contamination of water by corporate mining, oil drilling, paper pulp electric generation, and toxic agrochemical intensive industrial monocultures. Privatization by bottling companies such as Coca-Cola, PepsiCo, Nestle, Danone, who buy the water at an extremely low cost and sell it at over 1,000 times what it costs them. And finally, by monopolizing the technologies used for its extraction and purification. The three justifications that they use are population growth, the need to assign economic value to water, and the failure of the state. Large financial institutions and global trade deals also affect land use around the world. Because countries work with organizations such as the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund and the World Trade Organization to develop their countries, they end up with a large debt. One way to repay the debt is to basically open their countries up to the developed countries such as the U.S. and the European Union to take what resources and crops they need. The developing countries such as India and Kenya must fulfill trade deals. The foods that they produce then must be sold to the large industrialized countries rather than to their own people. They must import a certain amount of food from other countries, so if they have an overproduction of a certain product they must buy, then they have to destroy their surplus rather than sell it in their domestic market. For instance, in Jamaica, because the market is flooded with milk from the U.S., due to trade agreements, Jamaican milk producers must dump their milk. This in a country where malnutrition is a real problem. So the focus is debt repayment rather than the sustainability and self-sufficiency of the state. These debts often push developing countries further and further down. Systems and programs such as the Green Revolution, portrayed as the developed West helping, giving new technologies and thus revolutionizing world agriculture, actually did more harm than good. Dr. Robert Jessen, political scientist from the College of Santa Fe, explains how the Green Revolution and the new technologies and seeds that were given to developing countries changed self-sufficient methods already used for centuries.
But in terms of how it actually affects local economies or larger economies, it can look like it has a positive effect on the larger economy. But on the local economy, it could be absolutely devastating. For example, when it looks like it's good for the larger economy, bad for the local economy. Vandana Shiver, in her book Biopiracy, talks about when the Green Revolution came along and they gave them hybridized forms of wheat, which had very large heads of wheat and very short stalks, which seems, from a very sort of mechanical perspective, much more efficient, less energy in stock, more energy in the actual head of the wheat. The problem was local farmers used all that stock to feed their cattle. So although they were producing more wheat, now they had to buy food to feed their cattle. And Shiva calls that effect shadow acres, acres that are lost, because you start prioritizing one input and one output in a very mechanistic sort of linear equation instead of looking to maximize the entire equation. And these local cultures, often indigenous, especially in places like India, have evolved over generations, maximizing what works in a local situation and what helps their survival. An interesting and American example that Wendell Berry talks about a lot are the Amish. The Amish produce for themselves first, and then they have some things that they sell on the markets. And as a result, they're highly autonomous. And this is the political aspect of the equation, that if you produce food for yourselves, you have more autonomy, you're less vulnerable and dependent on anyone else. So the Amish can really do what they want because they don't depend on anyone else. And the state, meaning the government of the entire country, really likes you to be dependent on them. So there's this tension then between small local producers, which is sort of the basis of democracy, and the state itself, which wants to maximize all those transactions that it can tax. This is why the state hates peasants everywhere. Peasants produce for themselves. You can't tax that. It's very difficult. And when you do tax it, then you make very angry peasants.
Our cultures are based on the land. The way that our traditions and rituals evolve has much to do with our environment and what it asks from us. Cold places will have different needs than warm places. Humid places will ask for tradition and ritual different than what a dry place will. Each place asks for something else. Again, Dr. Jessen explains a little about how our global economy ignores this, placing what the large financial institutions have determined would be best for their profits.
That's still conditioned on the environment, and it's still conditioned on the place. So, for example, when I talk about how it's really the relationship with everyone else, conditioned by the relationship of the place. In New Mexico, we get these thunderstorms. If the thunderstorm rains on your farm and you have a great crop, and it doesn't rain on my farm, and I don't have a good crop, if we think short term, you'll just keep your crop and I'll starve to death. But next year, you might not get the thunderstorm. So because of our connection to the place, it becomes self-evident that we need to be able to cooperate with each other. Not compete, but cooperate. When I was working in Chihuahua, Mexico, in the Sierra Tarahumara, which is very similar ecologically to New Mexico, the Tarahumara have a word called corima. And corima, by the Mexicans there, is sort of what they see as asking for a begging, a limosna. And because they have very Catholic heritage, they say, okay, fine, I'll give you something. They don't judge. Corima is seen as just someone begging. And when I asked a Tarahumara man, one of my contacts there, Felipe Martin, how he would translate corima into Spanish, he said, pues Roberto, it means every man has a right to ask for help. That's what corima means. And that's part of the Tarahumara culture. And I see it as conditioned as a response, partially, to their environments. Your culture, then, I think, is developed by how you have learned to live off the land and how you have developed relationships with your other people in terms of living off the land. It's interesting, then, what happens when that economy changes. And it's really another reason why I wanted to study Mexico, because when I was studying Mexico at the time, it was when we were trying to pass the free trade agreement. Because we have what we call the Washington Consensus. We have this idea that our economic model will work for everyone without the recognition that it is the economic model, from my perspective, that conditions your culture. So by shifting someone's economy, we're actually saying, oh, and we want your whole culture to change too, which is not very democratic, actually. So we call ourselves the greatest democrats in the world, but simply because of our economic imperialism, we're actually undermining people's self-determination all over the world every day. with what we're doing with our economy.
Around the world, countries work to care for their people. Latin America is one example of a block of countries that for decades had had their resources exploited by foreign interests, to the point that the CIA even helped to overthrow democratically elected governments to replace them with governments that would continue to allow their resources to be taken. As a result, today a block of Latin American countries are working against this Washington consensus, creating stronger, self-sustaining governments, pulling the resources back to national interests rather than to foreign interests. Agriculture is a part of this. Trade is a huge part of global agriculture. Large financial institutions such as the World Bank, the World Trade Organization, and the International Monetary Fund make programs seem very attractive to developing countries that need capital to build their economies and infrastructure. The financial institutions require development programs for these countries, which focus on debt repayment rather than the state sustainability. As a result, the countries must produce products for export. Some of these products are food in an agro-industrial system, which the financial institutions promote. People criticize this as developing countries produce a few staple crops for wealthier countries rather than their own people. Oftentimes, these few staple crops are items which have no place in the country's traditional farming practices. This creates a codependent cycle of trade. One aspect of this is the farm subsidies that the U.S. and Europe and other developed nations give to overproduce food. The subsidized cost of production is then less than the real cost of production, creating a price which is unrealistically low. Poor countries have none of these subsidies, and so cannot afford to compete in the global market. The U.S. will not cut their agro-industrial subsidies. These false prices hurt not only developing countries, but also they hurt small domestic farmers in the U.S. as food prices are all falsely low.
Well, as a consequence, as a result of massive overproduction in developing countries, now we have to find markets for those goods. What better way to help mankind than to find some starving poor peasants in developing countries and give them food? Aren't we nice people? Well, what we're actually doing is completely undercutting their local economy and forcing their farmers off the farms and into urban centers. So we're doing with our overproduction what large markets did in the United States, a massive concentration of farming production. It was ironic in the 80s, late 80s, there was a Kellogg's commercial for Musilix where Max von Sydow intoned, "If life were as it was meant to be," and then you saw images of a peasant community, a woman with long flowing hair just washed in Breck shampoo, and a couple old guys sitting on a fence chatting with each other. And so we have in us this idea that, wow, wouldn't life be great if it were that way? And that's the peasant way of life, the rural way of life. And the irony is, it's corporations like Kellogg that are actually making that way of life untenable in the rest of the world.
You're listening to The Shift of Land, where we explore the connection between land, culture, and agriculture in New Mexico and globally. Ethnobiologist and farmer Miguel Santisteban talks a little about the fundamental problems of the agro-industrial system and world hunger and trade.
Well, world hunger, you know, we want to address world hunger. Okay, I don't buy that. There's probably some well-intentioned people, but again, they're probably towing the line of the corporations. Like, for example, everyone else talks about Africa. Why, if all these people and corporations are concerned about world hunger, why is Africa exporting all their agricultural products for the United States? Why are we drinking coffee 3-4 times a day from Africa when they can't feed themselves? You know, until you address that fundamental question of why don't those people have access to their own resources to feed themselves, then we can't do a technological fix. These questions are not complicated. They're complicated because we've made them complicated, but the fundamental issue is there. Africa has been victimized by slavery, victimized by the slave trade. Their resources have been taken over. Their continents have been taken over. There are covert operations all over Africa that are giving militia groups weapons that are being produced by corporations that are based in this country. And you want to address hunger without addressing that? Come on. It's not that complicated. We don't need to genetically engineer all of these crops to address hunger. You need to give people access to their resources and let them feed themselves, right? And then that means people in the United States have to take care of themselves too. We have to either grow our own coffee or make our own atole, or only buy coffee from somebody who's doing fair trade. And that we can go talk to those farmers and say, hey, is this a fair situation for you? Is this your own land? Is this your own coffee? Are you doing this in a way that's appropriate to your culture? Oh, you are? Cool. I'll buy from you. But no, usually it's Folgers or, you know, Maxwell House, who owns thousands and thousands and thousands of acres over there growing all these coffee, you know, slave labor still, cheap labor. And then we have these grandiose ideas of solving world hunger. The people in the United States have to look at their own standard of living and what it's connected to. What do they truly value? Because it's not that complicated. It's complicated if you try and really address the fundamental problems, you know, within the system. But the solution is simple. Let the people have access to their own land. Let them feed themselves. Create a program where desert farmers from Hopi can go over there and say, hey, this is how we do it with no water. Here's some crops. But instead, there's all of these bureaucratic and political institutions in the way. I couldn't even take seeds to Africa. Why? Because they want to control every aspect of the whole thing. I think it's very calculated. They know exactly what they're doing. And people who say, oh, well, we need to solve world hunger. It's like that vitamin D rice, that beta carotene rice they genetically engineered. So now they're feeding them genetically engineered rice when those people used to feed themselves. They had nutrient deficiencies because all their land has been taken over for development. Let the people grow their own food in the way. Like now, they're trying to genetically engineer an omega-3 pig. They're putting fish genes in a pig. And they're going to try and market it as some kind of cholesterol-reducing pork because it has omega-3s in it. Yo, eat a salad with your pork chop. We don't have to get all grandiose about this situation. If you eat a well-balanced meal with your pork chop, maybe some verdolagas, the weeds out there have more omega-3s than you'll ever get from a genetically engineered pig. Round out your plate. We don't need all these solutions. You know, oh, we need to do this for world hunger. Hey, it's not that complicated. But it is that complicated if you're a bureaucrat or a CEO, or on the board, or a stockholder of some corporation, then it's problematic. Why? Because then you're not going to have any profits off of exploiting other people's lands and labor.
Ultimately, land and culture are tied. In India, many farmers have committed suicide since 1999, when chemical companies came in to sell genetically engineered seeds which can't be saved and require pesticides. Farmers who traditionally farmed with a low cost and saved seeds are unable to profit with this model. They have begun to take their own lives by drinking the pesticides that their crops are dependent on. Again, Robert Jessen.
In India now, Vandana Shiva, who is an activist and a physicist, writes a lot about farmer suicides. Because it's not just their job they're losing, it's their way of life. And it's not just their way of life, but it's their fathers, grandfathers, great-grandfathers. They're the failure on the scale or the ladder of cultural evolution. They're the ones who couldn't do it, and they can't take it, so they kill themselves. That's the key concept that one has to understand when looking at family farms, local cultures, local agriculture, and the dynamics nationally and internationally, is once you go from providing food for a small market to a big market, then the small guy loses, and it's inevitable in terms of market logic.
This is Vandana Shiva in an interview with Amy Goodman in a December 13th, 2006 broadcast of the news program Democracy Now! Shiva explains the farmer suicides, along with how the importation of soy and palm oil has shut the market on locally produced mustard seed oil, which has had a direct effect on culture.
DemocracyNow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Vandana Shiva remains with us, physicist, ecologist, director of the Research Foundation on Science, Technology, and Ecology. In 1993, awarded the Alternative Nobel Peace Prize, the Right Livelihood Award. Her latest book, Earth, Democracy, Justice, Sustainability, and Peace. There is an epidemic you write about in India of farmer suicides. Can you explain what's happening and where this is happening?
Indian farmers have never committed suicide on a large scale. It's something totally new. It's linked to the last decade of globalization, trade liberalization under a corporate-driven economy. The seed sector was liberalized to allow corporations like Cargill and Monsanto to sell unregulated, untested seed. They began with hybrids, which can't be saved, and moved on to genetically engineered BT cotton. The cotton belt is where the suicides are taking place. On a very, very large scale, it is the suicide belt of India. And the high cost of seed is linked to high cost of chemicals because these seeds need chemicals. In addition, these costly seeds need to be bought every year because the very design is to make seeds non-renewable. Seed isn't renewable by its very nature. But whether it's through patenting systems, intellectual property rights, or technologically through hybridization, non-renewable seed is being sold to farmers, so they must buy every year. There's a case going on in the Supreme Court of India right now on the monopoly practices of Monsanto. Antitrust court ruled against Monsanto because the costs are so, prices so high, farmers necessarily get into a debt trap, which is why I was talking about credit for the wrong thing could actually be a problem and not a solution. In addition, the price of cotton is collapsing under the huge $4 billion subsidies given to agribusiness in the United States, which then dumps cotton on a world market with 50% reduction of price artificially. This is what led to the Cancun failure of WTO, but this is what is killing Indian farmers. Just 3 days ago, farmers were protesting against the low prices of cotton. They went to the government agency, which before globalization used to buy cotton at a fair price. One farmer was shot dead. So we are not just seeing suicides, we are also seeing farmers' protests as a new threat to the regime.
These descriptions of desperation, up to three farmers a day swallow pesticides, hang themselves from trees, drown themselves in rivers, set themselves on fire, or jump down wells, many of them plagued by debt, poor crops, and hopelessness.
90% of the farm suicides we've studied, and every year we bring out a report called Seeds of Suicide. We started the first report in 1997, which was the first suicide in the district of Warangal in Andhra Pradesh. Andhra Pradesh has...
Where is it in India?
Andhra Pradesh is kind of southern India. But Andhra Pradesh had a government that responded, and that's the government that took Monsanto to court. Vidarbha in Maharashtra has emerged as the epicenter. This is where the Prime Minister visited because the suicide issue had become so intense. Unfortunately, the Prime Minister offered exactly the same package, more of the same, as a solution. Included in this package is a 20 billion rupee seed replacement package, which means what seed farmers has get further destroyed, so they have no renewable seed, no affordable seed. They must buy in the market every year. Farmer suicides in Vidarbha are now 8 per day. A few weeks ago, I was in Punjab, 2,800 widows of farmer suicides who've lost their land, are having to bring up children as landless workers on others' land. And yet the system does not respond to it because there's only one response. Get Monsanto out of the seed sector. They're part of this genocide. And ensure WTO rules are not bringing down the prices of agricultural produce in the United States, in Canada, in India, and allow trade to be honest. I don't think we need to talk about free trade and fair trade. We need to talk about honest trade. Today's trade system, especially in agriculture, is dishonest, and this dishonesty has become a war against farmers. It's become a genocide.
Can you talk about the water tower protests?
In the state of Rajasthan, which is the capital of the production of mustard, and mustard in India is very symbolic. It's the color of our spring, When spring comes, we dress in the yellow of the mustard flower. It's our staple oil, and we love the pungency of it. 1998, Monsanto and Cargill managed to get a ban on indigenous oils in order to create a market for soya oil, something we've never eaten before. We led a movement of women to bring back the mustard. But today, 70% of the oil India is eating, edible oil, and India was the capital of edible oil production, mustard, sesame, linseed, coconut, wonderful healthy oils. Today, 70% of our edible oil market is soya oil dumped on us, palm oil dumped on us. And as you know, today soya is being cultivated in the, cutting the Amazon, and palm oil is being cultivated cutting the rainforests of Borneo. When the farmers can't sell their mustard, nobody's buying it. They've had protests. 12 farmers were killed in central India, and there was a farmer who climbed onto the water tower a few months ago, mimicking a Bollywood film, but basically saying he would jump to suicide if the farmer's mustard was not bought. This hijacking of the market for agriculture by a handful of agribusiness, which is what the rules of WTO are. The agreement on agriculture is basically putting all of agriculture into the hands of ADM, ConAgra, and Cargill, and all the seed sector into the hands of Monsanto. It must necessarily destroy more and more farms, more and more farming, and push more farmers to suicide for a while, unless we get a change. We work for the change, and our work in Navdanya shows that farmers can double their incomes by using their own seeds, doing organic farming. All they need is a joining of hands with urban consumers and definitely a change in the rules of trade, which have treated the rights of Cargill as fundamental rights. And something Americans don't know much about, the nuclear deal with India has a twin agreement, and that twin agreement is on agriculture. It's called the Knowledge Initiative in Agriculture. And on the board of this agreement are Monsanto, ADM, and Walmart. So a grab of the seed sector by Monsanto, of the trade sector by the giant agribusiness, and the retail sector, which is 400 million people in India, by a Walmart. These are issues that are preoccupying us for about democracy in India right now.
Another rather disturbing facet of global agriculture came with the U.S. occupation of Iraq. When the U.S. government came in, the new Iraqi constitution created a provision to set the way for patented seed and animal technology, effectively making it illegal to save seeds. This may not be a great concern today as the country is in the middle of a war. However, it sets the large chemical corporations to control the seed market when things stabilize. Global agriculture, with the government's trade deals that require quote-unquote low-risk crops, genetically engineered crops, means that our national agriculture must push on to remain competitive, continuing a dependence on fossil fuels and chemical pesticide and herbicides. In order for farmers in New Mexico to remain competitive in the national economy, they must rely on the same low-risk crops that we neither consume nor utilize. This program was made possible through a grant from the New Mexico Humanities Council in association with the National Endowment for the Humanities, as well as a grant from the Albuquerque Community Foundation. We would like to thank Jack Rappett for mailing support, Kit Carson Telecom for internet support, Venado Partners for web design, KRZA Radio, Dusty Yellow Thunder, associate producer, and all individuals who gave their time to be interviewed. Theme music was composed and performed by Fidel Gonzalez from El Caballero Aguila Recording Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico. You can hear full interviews and find more information about these issues at www.theshiftofland.org. I'm Sarah Parker. Thank you for listening.